Welcome, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to The Collective Perspective, reclaiming and reshaping theater, where artists from various identities, disciplines, and from across the country take a critical approach to the theater industry. If you appreciate the discussions being had on this podcast and want to support our creative activism, you can subscribe or follow us on Apple, Spotify, or all other major podcast platforms. To stay up to date with episodes, upcoming articles, and to get to know The Collective better, please like our Facebook page, The Collective Perspective, and Instagram at TCP Theater Podcast. Reviews are always welcome, and please leave comments or questions, as well as send us an email at tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com. Cool. I am also recording. Okay. Alrighty. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the fifth episode of The Collective Perspective. On today's episode, we are going to be discussing the article Towards a New Theater Model, written by Collective member Ana Sofía Villanueva, who is with us today, along with Lapika and myself, Shalana. And we are so excited to be jumping in and discussing this article today, because it was one of the first articles that sparked me to ask Ana Sofía to be a part of my graduate school assignment, which if you listened to episode one, you would have heard us talking about how that was one of our early motivators for even starting this podcast. So I'm very excited to get to jump in conversation. But before we jump in, I would like to start by having us go around and introducing ourselves, as well as checking in with each other. For today's check-in, what I would like for us to do is to give a rose and a thorn. A thorn is something that's not been going so great that's been happening in your life, that's happened either today or relatively recently to you. And then a rose is something that you're grateful for. I always stipulate for my students that you don't have to say a thorn if you don't want to or you don't have a thorn, but I do ask that you say a rose or a moment of gratitude. So the both of you are welcome to take that into consideration when you're answering the question. Great. Yeah, I will start. My name is Shalana Wunsch. I use she, her pronouns. And I would like to acknowledge that I am on the traditional land of the Coast Chehalis people, including the Duwamish people, past and present. I honor with gratitude the land itself and the Duwamish tribe, and this acknowledgement does not take the place of authentic relationships with Indigenous communities, but serves as a first step in honoring the land we are on. And I identify myself as an artist. I identify as an actor, a teaching artist, a producer, a stage manager, a photographer, and somebody with many other hats that I'm sure exist out there in the theater world. And my thorn is that I have been really struggling in 2021 to get my butt to do some yoga. And I love yoga. It's one of my favorite things, but I just have zero motivation. So it's just been, and that will then like eat away at me. And then it just becomes a cycle of me not doing yoga. But something that I am grateful for is a new book that I just started called Half and Half. And it is a collection of essays of individuals who come from multi-cultures and multi-ethnicities, and which is like a journey of like myself figuring out my own mixed race heritage and like where I fit in. And so it's been like a really nice to like listen to other people's stories. So that's something that I'm grateful for.
I'll go. Awesome. Hi. Again, I'm Lapika Shah, she, her, hers. I am coming at you from the land, the unceded land of the Munsee Lenape, currently called East Harlem, New York. I am an actor, primarily in theater when there isn't a pandemic going on. I also work in the English dub world for voiceovers. And, oh, I love this Rose and Thorn thing. We do this exercise in my Girl Scout volunteerism as well, and I always enjoy it. I would say that right now, my thorn is that it has been snowing and snaining and icing nonstop in New York City for what seems like 3 weeks. And I know this because I don't run when it is snowing and icing and snaining, and running is the one thing that has been keeping me sane this entire pandemic. But I also have a gift for finding that one patch of black ice and falling on it and then hurting myself. So I just avoid it when it is snaining and snowing. And so I can't wait to be able to run outside again. But this weekend, I convinced my partner that we could go for a walk. outside, surely we would be able to slowly make our way over any icy patches. And we did. And because I'm a big bird nerd, we saw a few birds that I've never seen before in New York. And it was very exciting. For any other bird watchers out there, those are the common brant, which is a goose, and the hooded merganser, which is a super cool duck. And I was really excited about it. Yay. Anna Sophia.
Great. I'm Anna Sophia Villanueva. I use she, her pronouns. I am a theater producer, director, writer, and activist. And I am currently residing on traditional unceded Yakima land in central Washington. A thorn. I had a bad workout that kind of put me in a funk today. I didn't have a lot of energy and I just felt like I just up. And I was feeling kind of down about myself for not being able to push through a little bit better. As far as the rose, you know, it's going on 5 years since I had a major injury that greatly changed my life, about broke my back and had to do all kinds of physical therapy. And it was very, very difficult for me to go from athlete to not being able-bodied. And I am now 3 weeks into CrossFit. My favorite sport is Olympic lifting, and started running a little bit before that, which felt great. So I'm also trying to remember that I am able-bodied and I can do my sport and I can know what it's like to have burnt lungs again and need food and have good sleep. So I am trying to remember what it was not even that long ago. So that is both my thorn and rose.
Yay. Yeah, awesome. Thank you both for sharing and introducing yourselves, giving us your roses and thorns. Plus, like I said at the beginning of this episode, today we're going to be talking about Anna Sophia's article, Towards a New Theater Model, which is the first in her Power Dynamics series from a mixed race Latinas perspective. And in this particular article, she talks about the death of theater and how defining the product of theater as authentic community engagement can help us break down our operational structure and business models in different ways. And she examines the subscriber model that is our current most predominant model of theater and what kind of audience base that is catering to. And then also looks at the changing demographics in our country and how that is going to affect our audiences moving forward. Something that I really appreciated about Anna Sophia's article is how you use the heart, mind, and body to visualize the different elements of business. So starting with the heart being the product or the service of the company, moving to the mind being that business model, and then the body, which is like that operational structure and the company culture. And something else that I also really appreciated about this article is that you get into, and I'll get into a little bit more detail about this as we continue on in our full discussion about it, but how you are defining the product as being something that can, how when we define the product, it can completely change the entirety of the structure and everything that is. And that seems like such a simple concept that if you just change the product, or if you define the product differently, or you examine the product, then you see where the flaws can actually align. But when we're looking in the heat of, like, we see all these problems and we see these things that, like, for the most part, the conversation about change is vibrant in the air. People are at least talking about some sort of change. But I feel as though this article really hit at the thing that we need to talk about first, which is the product. Because if we don't understand what the product is, how can we build a model based around it? So I just like how you took that very simple idea of what is the product that we have? And we're like, okay, so now if you have an understanding of what the product is, then you can then move forward and be like, okay, these are the options that we have to support that product. You give it the mind and the body, which from my brain just made it all click. As somebody who didn't go to business school, it helped. So I think that is a great place for us to start in our conversation, if the two of you agree. But before we do that, Anna Sophia, I would love for you to go through and talk to us a little bit about your series and anything you'd like to add about this article before we jump into defining product.
Yeah, so the series is called The Power Dynamics Series from a Mixed Race Latinas Perspective, aka my perspective. And it's a series of articles where I analyze the complex ways in which power is unevenly distributed within the theater industry. It was originally a commission with Minnesota Playlist, where I began writing about power dynamics, such as the current model and mainstream approaches to theater making, the changing landscape of American theater, white theater leaders' responses to the murder of George Floyd and performative allyship, the anti-Blackness, Indigenous erasure, and whitewashing of Latinxes in Hamilton and so many other great musicals, and how Latinxes are navigating predominantly white institutions or PWIs, reactions to the Black Lives Matter, and we see white American theater movements at the forefront. So as you said, this article we're discussing today, Toward a New Theater Model, was actually the first in the series. It was deliberate and very important to me to start by addressing the current dominant theater model. So often conversations and action steps towards change start and end with diversity, such as hiring. Such as hiring BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, and other people of color to be included in an established institution or a system. And I do think that can have some good. We do need greater diversity, but representational diversity and often tokenism rarely leads to systemic change and can do great harm to the BIPOCs who are hired and included. So if we're going to really talk about the power dynamics at play within our industry, I feel like we need to start by talking about the foundation for which decisions are being made and art is being created. And that's why I started with this article.
Yeah, awesome. So with that, Let's jump in. What is, I'll repeat the question I asked earlier, what is the product of our theater? What is it that we are providing slash selling slash giving to the people that are coming to see or engaging with the work?
I feel like on the surface, right? On the surface, the product is the production, right? That's when people think theater, you go to the theater to see a show and be entertained, and then you go home. And that for me was a really interesting component of your article is like, we can't just think of the product as production because it is in theory so much more. We're also asking audiences to engage with that production. We are asking audiences to participate in community engagement, which I think means different things to different people. But I think at its surface, when you ask an average person, like, what is the product of theater? They're going to say it's the production, right? That's the end game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you talk about that in your article, Anna Sophia, about how if the product is the production, like where it goes from there. So then that would become the heart, right? That you talked about. The product would be the heart.
Yeah. I mean, I throw a lot of numbers around there as I'm approaching it somewhat from a business point of view. Mm-hmm. But really what I'm looking at with these numbers are the trends. And we can see that in the trends of theater, financial trends, revenue coming from auxiliary, which is non-main stage productions, essentially, by individuals or grants or whatever source of funding, that has been increasing, whereas like ticket sales have been decreasing for decades now. So to me, there's still that suggests that, you know, it's not just about the play, that the thing that we're getting from theater can be found and maybe is greater value in non-play specific areas, which to me is like where community engagement and education tend to lie, which is a large funder of theater, how I got around to that community engagement component there.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was such an interesting point that your article brought up, the stats that you wrote out about how ticket sales have been going down. And so why is it that we, meaning the American theater, like keep trying to push production revenue as the ultimate end game when like the numbers aren't bearing that out? Like, why aren't we investing in these other avenues?
Yeah. Yeah. Something that really stood out to me is this a quote from the article here on page 3 of it. It means that they're with a strong dependency on ticket sales can't afford to take risks or to modify programming in fear of box office flops. And that stands out to me as something that is a flaw in our system. The fact that if we are so dependent upon these box office ticket sales, that you are then again perpetuating like who is the audience. Later on, it goes on to talk about the majority of our audiences are aging and white. And so we have this white aging audience supporting these shows. And if they are the ones supposedly providing all of the funding for us, then of course, then we're going to, they're as like a, as a biz, like strictly from a like profit business, I want to make profit. Then of course, I'm going to want to then cater these shows to those older white audience members, which isn't serving ultimately who will then eventually take over and is taking over to fund these theaters, because those white old audience members are old. And the reality of that is that eventually those white audience old members aren't going to be there anymore. And if we don't get different audience members in there supporting us, find different ways to support us, then literally just from a profit standpoint, like you talk about, Anna Sophia, we're not going to have anywhere to get this money from.
Yeah, and, we in trouble. That's not a good situation.
But as far as defining product, it's still doing a good job of that, because it just says that that's what they do, is they're engaging with their audience. The problem is that they're engaging with a very narrow scope of audience. They're not really serving multiple communities. They're serving one.
And I loved that you pointed this out in the article as well, that the way community engagement often happens in theater is still done in a way to address our predominant audience. Like, if you're doing a play that happens to be about an Asian family, you may do a little bit of outreach to the Asian community to get them to come see this one play, but you're not necessarily creating a welcoming space for this theater to be theirs too, which means that for this one play, you have increased and expanded the community that you want to be engaging with, but then you're not retaining that audience. And so you're back to the same problem that you had before.
That's nothing new. We've all seen that with theaters. And I've wrestled with this and working in PWIs, you know, like, I don't understand. We had this really successful ticket sales were through the roof. It was so unexpected. Of course, it's unexpected because it was like not centering white people. And they're like, oh, it actually sold tickets. Like, oh, it's a play with Somali characters and this giant Somali community came out, but then they didn't come out to the next one. And I don't understand. Why aren't they coming to the theater? It's like,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. You did. What about the next show? Did you do outreach for the next show?
Right.
I thought this was supposed to be universal.
1,000%. Why? Like, what incentive do they have to come to the next show if you're not making space for them?
Yeah.
That, to me, is a very broken piece of the current system.
Well, interesting, too, with the making space, that language around making space or, an inclusive environment, because it still assumes that an ownership of the space and the stories is that it's mine and you are welcomed into it. That felt very weird because in that scenario, I was a white theater institution.
We got you.
Yeah.
But it's still an inclusive mentality that assumes ownership, which is the problem, right? If we're talking about the product, is community engagement or maybe authentic community engagement, then who owns that product and which communities are we engaging? But that also like is really difficult to define.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it is. Because it's if community engagement is our product, then my question then is what then sets us apart from something like just a youth center or a community center that is providing some sort of community thing for it? And that is the fact that we do that through our art form. I think ultimately what theater is a conversation. It's a performed conversation, but it's about creating dialogue and space for dialogue and putting up a mirror to society in ways and challenging society in ways and challenging ourselves. And so therefore, to me, then the product is that engagement, that piece of community. Because if we don't have community within the theater, then what are we creating for?
Yeah, I personally don't think that there is much of a difference. I think that productions are a vehicle for carrying that product,
mm-hmm.
Which, again, back to the funding, there's a reason why so much of the funding is going towards education and community engagement components.
Mm-hmm.
But if we shifted, like you were saying, Lapika, shifted mentality from community engagement as this secondary source, like you said, it can be defined differently, community engagement. Like mm-hmm. so often we hear, I mean, that used to be a triggering term for me, and I don't use that word lightly. I really felt like it was kind of like the nexus of all the things that are evil in theater, because that's where so much of the tokenism happened and exploitation happened. It's that separate wing of the theater that's under the business that's somehow removed from the art. But really, at its best, that's what it does. That's why I don't even know very many people that got involved in theater that didn't have some sort of, that didn't speak to them, didn't engage them with their community at some level. So I always go back to that's always the product. And then defining the theater model is something larger too, on how do we then define the theater model. I'd love to hear how you define it.
Yeah. And Sophia, when you talk model, do you mean like the business model or do you mean the product line model? Because I feel as though, and maybe the two are related.
To me, I don't know that this is the answer, but to me, it's all of those parts working together. The product, the operational structure, and the money, the financial, the business approach. All of those three things working together in my mind. But wanting to get on a shared language when I do talk about this so that we can really break it down and not make assumptions and then ultimately have a conversation on program design.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying. I think for me, the model of theater really resonates quite closely with what you're talking about with this heart, body, and mind analogy. The model is creating a piece of work that is engaging with the, or like engaging with the community in order to create a piece of work, I think is for me the heart, or what should be, what I believe the heart should be, is that creating work with and for community. And the reason that it is with and for community is because I think, I believe that theater is about community. It's about creating community. It's about building community. It's about sharing in community. It's about being in communion with one another. And so for me, that is like the vision and the mission of it, that we should be providing for our community. We should be helping our communities to grow and helping each other to grow. And by growth, I mean both like growth in technology, growth in society, growth, but I also mean individual growth, because I think that in order for anybody to change anything, that you first have to work on yourself. And I think that the theater allows space for that as well. And so then like to get to that, I do believe that there needs to be a way of sharing in those responsibilities. But our current operational system is where I feel as though we don't fit or meet the bill. I think a lot of people could potentially agree that theater is for community and building community. They may think about community in different ways than I think about community. But that operational structure, that subscriber system, is where then it starts to break apart. And like, yes, there are flaws in like what we currently see as community and who we're building theater for, which we talked about with our white theater and our older white patron base. But then I also think that that comes back to coming down to that business model.
Yeah. What I love about what you pinpointed to there about some of the things that aren't working, we've talked about like not fully engaging with the diverse communities we're supposed to be serving. That's such a big one that we've already talked about. But like you also talked about the business model, the ticket sales, that's not working. And then the operational structure, how we actually operate, the oppressive working environments of theater. That is a major component that it cannot be solved just by adding diversity. You know, it's really a top-down approach where only a few people have all the information and knowledge of how decisions are being made and access to the boards. And the boards is also a big component of that operational structure. And that I think we all know has some pretty big flaws. you know, it's not typically, you know, typically boards are made up of people who are not theater makers and that are overwhelmingly white, wealthy. Their focus is on fundraising instead of holding theaters accountable and privileging the vision above the theater's vision above all else. Like, so that operational structure that you touched on there, Shalana, I totally agree. I feel like that's a big component that's often not addressed. I recently worked with a Latinx theater company and I really loved everyone I was working with. And it was awesome to have a different kind of interpersonal culture. But overall, I had the same issues working with them that I did in a predominantly white theater. There were still assumptions. There were still assumptions and overall the cultures and ways of working. That was still pretty oppressive because all that they changed was who was in there. They didn't change the structure.
I also just, something I'm hearing from both of you is making me think about the disconnect between the current operational structures and what theater views as the product. Like how, when I was trying to analyze your article for myself, I like drew this sort of triangle, but with arrows in both directions between the heart and the mind and the body. And right. I'm staring at my little drawing now. And I'm like, but the two-way arrow between like operational structure and culture of an environment is often working at odds with the stated goal of the product.
Yeah, because if we are truly making work that is community focused, then how do then we reflect that same community within our system, within our operational system? Like where is the communication? Where is the structural like power? Like where does the power lie? Yeah. Should it just be on this one in like one or two individuals? Should we just have an executive director and an executive manager who are in charge of the entirety and hold all of the power, and then like some information trickles down? Like, is that transparency? Like, is just opening up transparency enough? I don't think so. Is like shifting the entirety of the power, is that going to be enough? Like, is a model where we all hold power equally? Like, how does that work? How do decisions get made?
Yeah, I think those are amazing questions. And it makes me think a lot about like how I've had to develop a directing approach, right? So if we took this giant theater model and we broke it down to just a rehearsal room, when people talk about like, we're going to decolonize the rehearsal room and get rid of patriarchal practices. And I mean, I was that naive young person who was like, I'm going to do that, but then I don't know actually how to do it. And so yeah. I explore with things, right? I mean, Shalani, you were there for my grad school days of, I was not in grad school, but it was a grad school experience of experimenting with devised theater. I'm like, okay, all shared power. Okay, well, that was chaotic and sloppy. Okay, I'm not saying all devised theater is, but I'm like, okay, so maybe there is something beneficial with one person having the direction or being able to do it, but to guide. But can it be a guide instead of a force? Mm-hmm. You know, how can this be collaborative while I still honor that I am the outside eye? How can I be a leader, an artistic director, and not have it be the only person with the information and be the only person to make decisions? Because no matter how diverse I am, I do not encapsulate all diversity. I will have blind spots.
Right.
So right. I think that's a great, great way of thinking through this, what other models could be.
Mm-hmm. Like, what does power sharing look like when some kind of hierarchy is in place?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder too, because this makes me, and it has me thinking now, because I previously like taught leadership workshops, and it was making me think a lot about how like what one of the big things that we harp on in those leadership workshops is the fact that like you as a leader, your job is not to be the person with all of the answers. Your job is to be the person to like what signifies a good leader is somebody who can recognize other people's like potential and be able to help facilitate that, right? Like leadership is all about facilitation. And like, that's also my philosophy as an educator is like, I am a facilitator. I am a sub-learner with you versus the person with this like overarching power of knowledge. And so I wonder too, if then that is a part of it. If we need leadership, if we need leaders, we need actual leaders, people who can facilitate, who can take like be the holder of information, the organizer of information. Versus the person being like, this is how the only way.
Somebody, yeah, willing to go in and not have all the answers and willing to try stuff and fail and try again. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. But, and it's not just one person though, either. I think it's also like, it has to be that group of people willing to then jump into that journey. Maybe a part of it, of like what could be the change is like, it's our societal ideas of like how business and structure should be. It's a more of a, we as humans within the system of capitalism have believed ourselves to be within power, but yet we actually just need to go back to the basics of what we know to be leadership and good human like things of like our philosophy on how we build and how we create entirely.
Absolutely. Like this, the example of the Latinx theater company I worked with, like what might it have looked like if they didn't assume that their being would change, would change how they operate. Like, what if they went back and defined what is an artistic director? What are their responsibilities? I have often seen at larger institutions, artistic directors not being the best director. And that is, and maybe it is not because they are lacking in talent, but maybe it's because they are stretched way too freaking thin. And if you're good, if you're a good director, you got to do a lot of prep work. You got to do a lot of, there's a lot that goes into it that you just wouldn't have time for as an administrator of a multi-million dollar theater company. So I'm also like, what if we redefined the responsibilities? What if we redefined not just the product, but how we're doing all of this? We don't create a vision and a mission last minute. Maybe we really start there and let that build things up. Mm-hmm. But I do think it takes some redefining and looking at things with a fresh eye. Mm-hmm.
And you said this too, Anna Sophia, that like we need people who are willing to try these things to also be given the opportunity to try and fail and try and fail and redefine and tweak and fail and figure it out. Because who historically has been given the chance to fail upwards? That's a real thing in not just our industry, but like everywhere. Like, who is allowed to keep trying?
Yeah.
So I'm curious, have either of you seen any theaters, read about any theaters, done any research on theaters that are trying new things, that are looking at different operational structures or different business models or different ways of pushing these boundaries that I think we all are in agreements, at least the three of us are in agreements that like just aren't working. And part of it is due to overwork, right? Like something that I didn't like an artistic director, the amount of work that they have to do, like looking at their job description and looking at like their day to day, I would never want that job because it seems so chaotic to like have to be able to manage all of those things.
One of the theaters that comes to mind, you know, one of the first ones that comes straight to mind about trying something different, Mixed Blood Theater.
I love them.
I know. That's where Lupika and I met.
It's where we met.
It's why I moved to Minneapolis, was to work with Mixed Blood. I love so much about that theater. And it has a long practice of radical hospitality, which I'm not 100% sure about how this works. I know that you can reserve a spot in advance and pay, but they always like reserve seats or no matter what, there's no financial barrier. So there are no cost tickets available. I think that this has been really successful in a lot of ways where they can afford to take risks. Although even as I say, take risks, who's defining what is risky is always like a question of like, do you mean that we're going to do a, you know, a POC show out of February and you're going to call that risky? Like, oh, so that's a little, I'm a little hesitant about using that language, but I have seen some so-so productions there. And I've also seen some of the best theater I've ever seen in my life there. Cause they do take risk. They do provocative theater that's different. And I think I assume that has a lot to do with not being reliant on the same people attending every show. It's not the season ticket holders that they have to placate to. Although I also imagine that makes them heavily reliant on grants and alternate funding. So that's one of them that I've thought.
Yeah. I will say also my experience as an actor with radical hospitality is that it's not just reducing the economic barrier to theater. Radical hospitality is the goal of the program is to reduce all barriers to theater. So another aspect of the program is like, for folks who may have transportation issues and can't get to the theater, there is a van, a wheelchair accessible van that will come pick you up and bring you to the theater. Your seeing eye dogs are welcome. Every single show has closed captioning, not just a special night. One of the most incredible theater experiences of my entire life was the show we worked on together, Anna Sophia, when there was a closed audience for one performance of Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. There were 9 or 10 folks in there who were spread out through the entire house. And there were folks who were both hard of hearing and had visual impairments. And so as an actor in the show, I was watching this magical performance that was happening around me because we created an environment where you had these people who don't go to the theater very often because what are the accommodations that must be made? And there's all these barriers and sometimes it's too difficult or whatever. But we created an environment where each person had 2 interpreters that were
One person was signing into someone's hand or drawing on their back to give them a sense of where the actors were in the space and what was going on and what was being said. Some of those interpreters, their first language was not English. So there were sign language interpreters who were live interpreting the show for the interpreter. It was incredible because that to me, that was radical.
Yes.
To me, they were like, this entire show tonight is for these 9 people.
Yeah.
I offer also Cal Shakes out in Berkeley, Orinda. Mm-hmm. They have a large outdoor amphitheater. And last year, like many theaters, not able to do any shows, even though they were outdoors and in theory outdoors is safe, but they closed everything down and they have been having some serious discussions about how to reimagine the model that we're talking about and how to move away from reliance on subscribers, which as your article talks about, Anna Sophia, it is a dwindling number. So this year, Cal Shakes recently announced that they are, instead of having a full season of their own, they're doing what they're calling a season of shared light, mm-hmm. where they are going to produce one show and they're then going to share the space with a bunch of other Bay Area theaters to allow more companies access to this type of space to expand the audience, I imagine, to reach demographics and areas of the community that maybe they hadn't been prior, to try this experiment of not programming their own singular vision. They're bringing other people in and sharing that power, which I thought was really, really cool. And I'm really excited to see what they do.
Yeah. And I'd love to hear more about how that works financially. Are they getting funding to support others? Is it a shared funding where they pool resources? I'm curious about that, but that sounds like a great approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are great questions. I have no idea.
Yeah. I also like that you're talking about theaters that so far we've mentioned too, that we've loved working at, which is interesting too. Like, where do we feel safe? And I think that is reflected. And I think I'm using that word correctly here in terms of I can be myself and I don't feel like there's going to be repercussions for that and can be creative. We're talking about theaters where we can do that. And I think that it is supported by the structure. Another one that comes to mind is Pillsbury House Theater, which is also in Minnesota, Minneapolis, 5 blocks away from where George Floyd was murdered. And it's probably one of the places where I have most been able to bring my whole self into the rehearsal room and not as a representative for all women or all Latinxes, just me. It's even the place where I first publicly talked about being a recovering alcoholic without fear that I would lose my job. And, you know, I've actually given some thought about why is it that is such a place that I have felt like I can work there? And I think a lot of it has to do with the co-artistic directors. There's 2 of them. So that's a shared leadership there. One of them is, I read as a Black woman, I don't know her very well. Another one that I've worked with routinely a lot is a white woman who I can say is one of those, is a person who really practices continual education. And so I think that they're great leadership and that co-leadership, but they're also part of a foundation. So it's the Pillsbury Foundation, I believe. And so that means that they don't have a board. And money is part of the foundation. I have some grants and EDI work that they do, equity, diversity, and inclusion. Money part of the Breaking Ice program, which I direct and facilitate for a lot. But I think that that's so interesting that those are all places that we like to work and that are doing something on a structural level that's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's really interesting because I, on the flip of that, tried to answer this question that we had come up as questions to ask and talk about in this podcast. I struggled to find theaters. I tried to look as locally as possible first and expand out from there. I struggled to find theaters that were actually doing change. I read a lot of statements. I read a lot of committees being formed. I read a lot about bringing in and committing to hiring out of their normal pool of hiring. I read a lot of those types of statements, but those statements just seemed like that, just statements of forming these committees of they're still in the step of figuring things out, which can be valid. They're still in the step of figuring things out, right? We're also, we're in a global pandemic. We're trying to figure out how to even do theater. So like there's like, but it, to me, it spoke volumes to like, we're still in that stage as a country in general. Like we're still trying to figure out what we can do to break apart this system. Yeah. And I think it does come back to defining what the product is, like going back to like why it is that I think that this article is important and why I wanted to continue these conversations is like, if we don't know what it is that we're trying to give, then how can we figure out how to change it? And I still feel like they haven't figured out that that is the question that should be asked.
Yeah, at PWI, that's in that process of transition that I've learned a lot about recently is Artist Repertory Theater in Portland, Oregon. And a lot of those statements, hiring outside, doing stuff with their programming. But something that I thought was really interesting in terms of shifting operational structure is I recently heard their executive director, J.S. May, I want to say that they're going through this capital campaign to restructure their theater company or create a new theater building, sorry. And they're centralizing the staff in all the same working area. So instead of the artistic separate from the business wing, everybody's going to be in the same space. And that doesn't seem like that radical, right? Like it's like, okay, you're putting office spaces in the same spot. But I actually think it is, because as theater artists, you might be aware that when we're in space together, we tend to collaborate together. How we are in relationship to each other in space matters. And so I don't know what they're doing in terms of, how that might shift things. But I do think that just even that simple practice of like, how are we going to be in collaboration with one another in physical space?
Yeah.
I was thinking earlier about what you were both saying about this idea that all these theaters are putting out a lot of words, statements. Well, a lot of good intentions, a lot of desires to act. We see White American Theater's 7-month accountability report just came out. And I just thought it was really interesting to look through the report and see not just what theaters have addressed some of the demands, but what demands they chose to tackle first and what is still like, we're in process. Like, you know, I think this is going to take a lot of time. But I truly hope that theater institutions are willing to put in that time, because in all honesty, Lady Dane said this in the last episode, like, does the theater institution want to be obsolete? Because if the answer is yes, then keep doing what you're doing. Great. But if you don't want to be obsolete, there are some big, hard changes that like need to happen.
Yeah. What are some ideas? What are some possible new ways? And I know that like the three of us in this room are not business experts by any means. And I don't believe that by the end of however long we spend on this question of like, what are possible new ideas, that we will have an answer. But like, what can we do? How can we change? The problem is there. I think we can agree on that. So then now what are some steps? What are some ways? What are some things that we can look into, explore? Where can we have that freedom for failure? What of our own collective agreements is the freedom for failure? So where can we go and fail next?
Yeah. Well, I think I said this in the article, but I am super interested in a cooperative model. I mean, artists and community members having as primary stakeholders, you know, how they can invest their own resources of time, labor, and money, and in return benefit from that. I just, is there a way to engage audiences in a way that they have real stake in that company? That's something I'm super interested in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think with that, I think breaking down even the barriers that we have between art forms, that's something that I think I'm really passionate about, is why are we putting boxes over everything that we have, and how can we continue to engage with our audiences and expand upon what it is that we consider to be the product of theater, right? Especially if we're going out into communities and doing more community engagement and like actually engage with our community and creating work for our community, not all of that work is going to look like this product of theater that we always imagine it to be, I don't think, nor should all of that work look that way. Like if I'm working with youth, for example, and we're creating a project together and there's a strong visual element, I as an educator would never turn down that strong visual element. I would never say, no, that's not what theater is, even if the storytelling doesn't look the same way that we see storytelling, because that's for that community. And I think that ultimately, I think that's my, like, what I feel like we should be our approach to all work that we do. If we're creating work that is truly for the community, then we need to engage with the community, and we need to create the work that and make it look the way that that community wants it to look.
Them do it. I mean, and us do it. That we them thing is starting to ring in the back of my head again. But because, I mean, I remember Shalana being in school with you, and we did this weird piece, Pollux.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it was like, it was weird, but it was like, but it was beautiful. It had music and dance. There wasn't a lot of dialogue, and there were all these spirits, which is such a, like, I don't know how to write a story without a spirit. It's like, that's what mi gente does. Okay. We have spirits. And I remember the director coming up to me and was like, oh yeah, it was really well done. And the choreography was well executed. But you know, I really didn't feel like it was for me. And this is a white man. This is white man who I wanted to say, yeah, it wasn't. I didn't feel like it was safe for me to say that at the time, but yeah, I'm like, it wasn't for you. This isn't, not all theater has to be for you. And in fact, the fact that we keep doing that and saying that we want it to look like that community, or like we want it to be inclusive, it is that mentality for why we're not engaging with the younger, racially and otherwise diverse population that is going to be the majority of this country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I echo that 1000%. I feel like in addition to what you were just saying, Shalana, about figuring out ways to bring in new mm-hmm. audiences to mm-hmm. like actually authentically engage with people who could be theater goers, but who've never been given the opportunity because of barrier after barrier after barrier after barrier. I'm also very interested in educating the current audience about why and how things are going to change. I'm going to give an example. When I worked at ACT in San Francisco mm-hmm. of 2019, they just gotten a new artistic director who they're in the process of a lot of change. I will not discount the historic practices of that institution, but they are in the process of a lot of change. Mm-hmm. And one of the amazing things that happened while we were doing this production, every program had a little insert called the rules of play. No one can see that I'm making air quotes because this is a podcast, but there are air quotes. But it was like any response, it was just a list of things that I feel like were directed at the traditional audience of that theater, saying things like, whatever response you have to this play is correct. Whether that is a loud response or a quiet response or a laughter response or whatever response is right. And it went on from there. And it was so refreshing, because I can't tell you how many times I've been shushed in a theater for laughing at something funny. Mm-hmm. Like, there was a really funny joke, man. I bet the actors are really appreciative of the fact that it's laughing. And I'm sorry that you're upset by my laughter. But it's always me being shushed by an older white person. These rules that you seem to be operating under, who made these rules? Did you decide these rules? Where do these rules come from? I don't like them. And those rules that have been there are one reason why people don't come back.
Yeah. And that's so true, because like my sister, love her to death. She knows nothing about theater, but she tries to support me so much. And she's learned a lot in the last few years. But even when I was younger, my family can be very embarrassing. So like I abided by those rules of like, you need to be quiet in a theater. Like you can laugh when it's appropriate to laugh, but probably not too loud. And I ingrained that so much into my sister and my family that when I did my first interactive show, she came to it and didn't know what to do. When people started talking to her, she panicked and was like, my sister's gonna kill me if I talk to you. Because I had continued to perpetuate that idea that like a theater should be a way that it should be, like that it had to be, like that it had to, that you had to go to the audience and be in the audience and be silent, and that you there's only one way to engage with the work, which I recognize is not true. There are many ways to engage with the work. There are many ways to react to theater, to be in communion with theater. And the more ways that we expand that, the more excited it is just as an actor. And also as somebody who's like producing work too, watching people actively engage with work is much more interesting for me on the producing end of things than it is to watch people like passively and be like, oh yes, that was good. Mm-hmm.
I want to shout out Steppenwolf as well. You talked about them throughout your article, Anna Sophia, and I loved what you wrote about the way that they've started implementing talkbacks every day, mm-hmm. not to meet the actors or talk to the actors about how did you memorize all those lines or whatever, but just to allow space and time for the community who attended the show to engage with each other about what they had just seen. It's not about like access to the star or the director or something. It's about engaging with what you saw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was the production staff that was specifically doing that, not the actors, which I always think is like, God, what a way to re-traumatize people.
As an actor, I always love to like hide in the back of the house because I want to hear what people took away from the show. But when I'm up there, the questions are very different. The experience is very different. And oftentimes I'm in the position of having to defend my work. We can't just engage with what happened. Anyway, that's a whole other story. Talk back trauma.
I also think that there is something interesting about breaking down just as simple as where your office is located within the theater and like how we separate people so like into like these different categories and like physically in space. Like you had mentioned earlier talking about artist repertory theater, Anna Sophia, and I think that there's something really interesting there because having briefly spent a time in the middle of this pandemic world in the tech industry, seeing if I could make some money there and realizing that that was not what I wanted to do nor and went against everything I believed in. However, they don't have permanent offices. They don't even, some of their locations don't even have permanent desks. In fact, sometimes they show up to work and they just sit wherever it is they do. And they do that to help and get to like continue that engagement with each other. And I think honestly that is something that maybe we could take from the tech industry of having these open working spaces and these different alternative working spaces. Cause I think that there's something in that.
Yeah, you and I have even talked about that as like, how can we break down some of those barriers, even working remotely? And we've mm-hmm. talked about different softwares, possibly even for this podcast, of like Asana that like centralizes all the information and centralizes all communication and really reinforces an even distribution of information. So there's ways of like that. But it also makes me think as far as business model is like, this idea of brick and mortar, like, man, that has hit theaters hard. Is there a way that we can have a theater that is not land-based? I mean, look at all of the people that are part of this podcast. And I know I'm always annoyingly optimistic of like, there's so much good that has come out of all of this horrible stuff. But one of the good things is that we are in communication with people that we haven't been able to be. I mean, this is 12 collective members across the entire country right now working on something together. So I do think that there is possibility too for a more nimble, maybe not land-based model.
I also think we can't talk about new ideas for theater without acknowledging a need for a change in the economic and financial side. The like, which I'll also say is probably a future podcast episode, so stay tuned. Like the current funding model for theater, where money comes from, what is given, which theaters are given funding, and then which productions are given funding, and how that funding comes about, and who is the,
I think we're going to title that episode, The White Supremacy of Philanthropy.
Ooh, that's a good title. Yeah. I mean, that has to change. Yeah,
absolutely.
For many reasons, the least of which is that funding model is not sustainable. You know, there are many other reasons that are actually more important than that.
In addition to the cooperative model and the things that we were talking about, I found these two models that I find interesting, and you may have heard of them or you may not have. The first model, the like business model that I found, is a low profit limited liability company. So that's an L3C. So instead of an LLC, that's a low liability company, or not low, something. Limited liability company is an LLC, but a low profit limited liability company is a hybrid structure between a a nonprofit, a 501(c)(3). There's lots of letters. I'm going to stop trying to name them. A nonprofit and then a for-profit company. It's a hybrid between the two. Wow. And the creator of this type of project is Robert Lang. And the way that he defines it is it's a business with a soul. And so what this provides is an opportunity for a more charitable purpose for your for-profit institution. Yeah. Which just makes taxes simpler in that realm. It's not offered in every state in the United States. There's only 6 to 7 or 8 states that actually offer an L3C versus an LLC option as far as a for-profit company. But I felt like this idea got a little bit closer to an idea of theater for community because it has that space,
yeah,
which I thought was really interesting. And then in the research that I had done, an alternative to that too as well was this the benefit operation, which basically is where you use some sort of actual money-making thing to profit your nonprofit. For example, I know in Seattle, there is a school that works with newborn through all the way through adulthood, individuals with disabilities, and they use a benefit operations by outsourcing people to do work either, I think they do laundry, they've got a big hotel laundry service that they do, and that's completely separate from their work with people with disabilities, but that is what is funding that work. And then they've got other branches doing other things that are helping funding that work. And I thought that was a really interesting business model of how creating a more flexible, it allows you then to have that nonprofit be that flexible purpose and that wing that's working towards things, but then have this engine to propel it financially. Mm-hmm. Both of those options I felt were really interesting because you could work, they can work in tandem. The benefit of having a benefit operations is that you have a more flexible purpose. Your nonprofit can be is a little bit streamlined as far as what your purpose is, and you can have the more specificity. But the L3C, the low profit limited liability company, is an easier tax bracket. So it makes taxes easier. Which is a lot of things that I don't quite know how you do business taxes for any of these things or the specifics of how we would function. But things that stuck out to me as interesting ways for us to get closer to what I believe to be the product of actual authentic community engagement, and what I believe the two of you also.
Cool.
Yeah. I'm going to admit that there were several things in what you just said that I did not understand. I'm going to Google them later.
That's fair. I had to do a lot of Googling, and that was the easiest way that I have those two things. But I think that those are interesting. And I wonder too, particularly this low profit limited liability company, because looking at co-op systems, the only co-op system that I could think of off the top of my head is a co-op grocery store, or REI is considered a co-op.
I love REI.
And membership. I also love REI. people buy into this membership system, and then they have a voice in that. And at the end of the year, they get some sort of profit incentive based off of how much they were engaged in the store. For REI, it's based off of how much you spent, but it's all percentage wise. But I don't know how legally you would register a co-op to business, and maybe there is a specific way, but this low profit limited liability company seems to be a way that I could recognize if you had the people, if it was registered under this low profit liability company, then you could have the co-op system function under it. How do you then register? I guess that's a question I have of how do you register a co-op to business?
Mm-hmm. I also have the question. I like the idea of co-op where everyone has a say, or not a say, where everyone has a stake, and then everyone can also reap the benefits. I have questions about how that applies to theater, because does that mean that theaters move back towards a company model? Does that mean, how do artists as freelancers fit into that system and that structure? And then I also have a lot of questions about the company model in terms of equity and fighting tokenism and all of that. So it just brings up questions for me. But again, we didn't promise solutions. We just we have ideas.
Yeah. And things that do come to mind on that about how that might work is maybe, and I don't know, but things that I had thrown out there, voting, having voting maybe power for relevant topics to be talked about or to select local artists to be commissioned. Maybe it is more project to project. And like you were kind of saying about that theater organization that you did a shout out for earlier, maybe that's something, or maybe it's more of a theater as a mechanism for creating community projects. I think that could live in that cooperative model where it's like, okay, that this, we're going to work on this school or this food bank or playground or whatever it is that, and that's in the community. And maybe that there, it would allow for more funding then. Cause one of the white supremacy of philanthropy episode, one of the things I'm going to talk about would be, you know, measurable outcomes is bonkers for theater. That's bonkers. Mm. But what?
Who's measuring? How do you measure? What's your metric?
I love transformed. It's like, well, maybe it doesn't happen in one play, or maybe it does, but how do you measure that? Physical, tangible things that you can see. Maybe there is more money. And again, that goes, I think, kind of more of a nonprofit mentality there. But maybe there is ways to like really service the community. And sometimes that's plays, or maybe it's plays, then funding, then getting more money to do the plays in order to fund the thing.
Yeah.
But as far as individuals, I have so many questions about that. What I would say as far as like, because something I've been thinking about, like, why does this matter for individuals? Right? Like,
yeah.
I think the freelancers is a big one, you know, but as far as like individuals starting a theater company, I love all of this. And I hope that people that are starting it will like look into cooperatives and look into, I'm not going to say the initial Shalana because I can't remember them, but the stuff that Shalana was looking into.
LC. 3-2-B-L-Q. I don't know.
An L3C and a benefit operation.
Yeah. Yeah.
What she said.
I think that research should be done, but I want to ask people like to not start with programming and to creating a company in order to produce vanity projects, or think that just because the company is diverse, it will be somehow different. I would ask that people start with the vision, the thing, the change they want to see, and mission, how that company mm-hmm. specifically is going to achieve that vision. And then create the business model and operational structure that foundationally supports that change, that they are not thought of as separate things. Because I think that is where the uneven distribution of power happens.
I feel like programming should be the last component.
Programming should be the last thing in that comes from the vision, that comes from the business model, that comes for like, that is the vehicle, right? That we were talking about earlier, if we define it in that way. So for people starting from that place, it's just going to replicate, inadvertently, likely replicate a lot of the same oppressive structures that we are currently fighting against.
Mm-hmm. All of that is like specific to individuals who are either thinking of or in the process of starting their own companies. And I think that is super important to keep in mind. But I don't know what individuals currently in the system can do to support these new, like this idea of moving towards a new model. And I'm coming at this from a very biased perspective because I'm an actor and I often feel like the least empowered person in the room. Like I often feel like I don't have, like it's not safe to speak up, or I won't have support if I speak up. And so like the only way I know to combat the current structures within the system that as it exists right now, the model as it exists right now, is to ask for what I need, which often is pushing back and questioning the lack of diversity and the why have you programmed this tokenized play and without the resources to support the actors that you're then tokenizing and et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, I was like racking my brain earlier, like what can individuals do when individuals in this system often feel so disempowered?
Yeah. Is that a good question? I would encourage individuals or freelancers to research and look at the model that the theater they're being hired for, considered for, is operating within. And I would even encourage people to like look at theaters' taxes. I mean, where do these theaters literally place their values? And if you can't afford to, and I recognize people cannot because rent is real, but when you can, I would speak honestly and openly, and of course, respectfully about how their model is not working, or maybe in some cases is working. But I think ultimately, Lady Dane last episode touched on this a little bit about the power in numbers. Yes, actors have the least amount of power in the way that it is broken down in the traditional hierarchy. Sure. Yes, but there are a lot of us. And I do think that there is a lot of power in saying no. But I say that cautiously because rent is real. But when you can't afford to say no, I think that there is power in that. I also think following up with that and saying why. I was recently offered a job to direct a show, and they sent me a script, and it was centering a Chicano character. And I read it, and it ended up being very problematic and pretty racist. And I ended up telling them that, you know, ultimately, thank you. I know you were looking for a Latinx director. I am not Chicana. but also said why. Here are the problems with this. And not only do I not feel like this is my story to tell, I also find these problems with it. And I hope this doesn't hinder you from reaching out to me in the future. But I am also in a position where I am not going to take work unless it feels authentic. But I also recognize that there isn't a label there on should or shouldn't with actors. But I do think that there is some power in saying no and looking at these models.
Mm-hmm. You know, I do think that's why the We See White American Theater document had created such a stir, so to speak. There were so many names just attached to the initial letter. And then so many more names that signed in solidarity. And I think that's why that and the fact that they're following up and they're calling people out unabashedly and demanding change, like not asking, it's that power of numbers is one reason why that's people are taking it seriously.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I do believe that if enough people said no and why, that I do believe that people can change, and I believe that they can learn. You know, maybe I am not in team burn it down. I believe that it is possible to restructure and do that. But I'm also placing a lot of the labor on the people who are being hurt usually the most. And I recognize that as well.
I think that you might actually be on Team Burn It Down more than you think you are, because I think that there might be a misunderstanding about what Team Burn It Down is, but I feel like because what I mean by burn it down is going back to the basics and looking at the basics of what it is that we are doing and starting from there, which is what I feel like this article is forcing us to do, is to go back to the basics of, like, literally take everything you know about your business, throw it out the window, and sit down and look at what the product is, right? That first conversation that you probably maybe didn't even have when you started this theater company, who knows how many years ago, because you assumed the product was just theater. And we all know what the product of theater is, but it's like, but did you have that conversation about what it actually is? And then did you build up from there? And I think that's it. That's what burn it down means in my brain, is less of like, let's burn down the whole system and like with actual physical flame, and let's start over. Let's examine this from the beginning.
Okay. I love that. I interpreted that more of like cancel culture of like, you know, let's not work with any PWIs and like, let's not do this old model. We have to do something complete. Like, and to me, it's like, I think that we are quite capable, as I think theater artists are truly remarkable and innovative and creative and hardworking, and that we actually can, we can restructure, we can undo a lot of this stuff. So, okay. I'll join your team. I'll burn it down with
it's you. It's the burn the current system down. The current system needs to be fixed. Burn the current system down. There's a...
Okay.
What is it? A parenthetical? Parenthesis?
There's an asterisk.
You had it right the first time.
Yeah, because one thing that I really like about the beginning of your article, Anna Sophia, is when you're talking about theater is scrappy, it's resilient and defiant. And then you share a little bit about your experience, but at the end of it, it provided a community where we can be truly seen and heard. Irrelevant? No. Theater is more than irrelevant, it's essential.
Yeah.
And I agree with that. I think, and that's again, going back to that basis of like what it is like, for myself, like I fell in love with theater because it gave me a sense of community. And so from there, then I want to create shows that are based off of community because that's what I get from the product. That's what I get as a person who participates in the artistic art form.
Yeah. I don't want to burn it down because I don't love it. Burn it down. I love it. I want it to I want it to thrive. I don't just want it to survive.
Yeah. And with that, I would love if we could all, for our closing, share a one-word reflection. If you could describe this conversation in one word, what would that word be? My word is stir. I'm ready to stir the pot. It might have been three words. It's fine.
I think my word is revolution.
I think I'll cheat too, Shalana, and I'll use a hyphenated word. Go with forward thinking.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much for joining me on this conversation. Thank you, Anna Sophia, for writing this article and joining us here to discuss it. I would just like to, before we go, give a shout out to, we didn't talk a lot about legislative theater as an option or a different alternative for business models, but I definitely think it's out there and an option that is worth looking into. I know we've mentioned it before on the podcast, but Be an Arts Hero, which is a group of artists, legislators who are pushing for arts-based legislation. And right now they're in the middle of their 100 days of arts activism, which mirrors the first 100 days of the Biden-Harris administration. So what they're doing is engaging with legislation, hard data, and various initiatives, which include arts and culture workers from a multitude of disciplines and congressional districts. So they're looking at that different funding model and that different way of how we can do the thing that we like to do.
Yeah, I will encourage everyone to go check out We See You White American Theater, WCUWAT.com to read their accountability report, which dropped recently. And I'd also love to give a shout out to Groundwater Arts, which is a collective of theater makers who have authored something called the Green New Theater, which is a, I will read their definition because it will do this better than I can because I love it so much. Green New Theater is a movement building document that outlines strategies, ideas, and principles that can help individual artists and arts organizations working in live performance change how they work to adapt in the face of the climate crisis. So it is a core community project of theirs that is specifically looking at ways to change current models because the climate change is real, the climate crisis is real, and our industry is not exempt from having to address it. So a lot of the different structural changes that they are challenging folks to make parallel a lot of the stuff that we've discussed today. Check them out at groundwaterarts.com. And I'm fairly certain on socials at Groundwater Arts as well.
And Sophia, would you like to tell people where they could find more information or your articles or your series?
So if you want to go back and read the articles from the Power Dynamics series from a mixed race Latinas perspective, you can do so on minnesotaplaylist.com, mixedracelatina.com, or on my website at anasofia.me. That's anasofia.me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. Thank you everyone who listened to today's episode, and have a great rest of your week, y'all.
Yeah. See you next time.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope that you will join us on the first and third Friday of the month for each new episode. To stay up to date on episodes, you can subscribe on the platform you are currently listening to. Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at TCP Theater Podcast. We really appreciate your reviews, comments, or questions. And you can always reach us at our email, tcptheaterpodcast@gmail.com, or through any of our social media. Thank you for listening to The Collective Perspective, reclaiming and reshaping theater with
Alex Reed,
Ana Sofia Villanueva,
Cambria Pereira,
Lilia Hushman,
Lupika Shah,
Oogie Push,
Saimukda Dwampusai Vongsai,
Sequoia Hawk,
Shalana Wanch,
Sophie Payton,
Tia Jemison,
Vahishta Vafadari.